where she was, and the fact that she had gone to a pretty dark time. For those of you that weren't here, the church had gotten in league with the state, specifically the French or Frank kings at the time. And then you went through a 150-year kind of dark period. And then on the other side, you had the Germans come to power with Otto the First. Otto saw that if they were going to, if he was going to have power, one of the best ways to do that was to put his people inside the bishops, right? So then all of a sudden, the church and her leadership started to go askew, started to become more run by people who were in the pockets of the state and not necessarily people who cared about piety and the church. The other thing that happened is that you began to get reform movements. That happens through 100 years or so, and then people understand and realize this cannot be the way that the church is. And so you have multiple different ways, multiple different things that the church tries to do to reform herself. One of those things was a monastery movement. Keep in mind, again, the monasteries were an institution where a lot of your clergy came up through the monasteries. But the monks by this time, we talked about this last week, the monks by this time, people were complaining about the monks. The monks were no longer living in such a way that people looked at them as this ideal. But instead, they were coming to town, they were being drunk, right? And they got to live lives of gluttony and laziness because the landed wealth and the landed owners were the ones who were spoiling them, hoping that their monks would come to power and by virtue, they would get more power and influence. In order to combat that, you had Cluny, and we'll see Cluny now will play a large part for us going forward. It's the monastic order trying to reform itself. It's saying, hey, if we want to get this right, we go all the way back to kind of Benedict, who's the one who set this up. We go back to his three rules, and we make it even more strict. Now you can't even talk. You're only allowed to talk for 15 minutes, right? Which would drive someone like me nuts. There's no way I would have been a Cluny monk. And then you get the friars, and the friars try to reform, but they try to reform from the outside. They say, look, this landed wealth thing is the thing that's corrupting the church, so we refuse landed wealth, right? We're no longer going to be tied down. We're going to travel around, the first kind of itinerant preachers, if you will. We will travel around, and people will support us just based on our masses, right? Has kind of a sink or swim mentality. So the friars end up becoming very strong because those who can actually make a living are those who give good masses, people that will come to them. The other thing the friars do is because they learn through the university system. They don't learn through the monastery system. They learn through the university system. The university system slowly begins to be taken over by the friars. Okay, and so by the time you get to the Reformation, when you see the teachers in the universities, they're almost all friars, and they talk against the monks and the monastery movement. And so those two take aim at one another. Sets up a lot of the arguments that the reformers will later take up. Okay, well, then you also have reform inside the papacy itself. That's where we left off, and that's where we will pick up now. It's important to remember the level of corruption. Keep in mind that you get events. This happens in history. Outside of church history, this happens. You get events and you get people that become lightning rods for reform. Let me give you an example outside of church history. In 1911, there was a factory fire in New York. The name of the company where the fire happened is the Triangle Waste Company. And they made waste as in your waistline, right? Coats, waistcoats, not waste as in refuse. And they made waistcoats, right? Well, this is the end of the Second Industrial Revolution. Women were not seen as being reliable workers, and so what happened oftentimes were women are either chained to their workstation or the exits were chained so that they wouldn't leave. Because you know those women, they were always taking coffee breaks and they were always talking, they wouldn't do their work, right? Well, such was the thinking of the end of the Second Industrial Revolution. There was worker and health and safety issues that were kind of roiling under the surface because there had been a number of like minor accidents, not M-I-N-O-R, minor as in, you know, pick mining, coal mining, right? Those type of accidents had killed hundreds of miners. But it's one thing for miners to die in the foothills of West Virginia. It's a different thing for women to have something happen to them in New York City. And so this fire breaks out. And they occupy three floors on this factory, the 8th, 9th, and 10th floor. Well, the women on the 10th floor and the 8th floor are able to get out. The women on the 9th floor, not so lucky, because the doors were chained. Right? And so they were left with the same kind of decision the men and women 9/11 were left with. You die by fire, you die by falling onto the pavement. Right? But those are the only options. Well, a reporter was there. She or he writes the story, and this becomes the reason for a lot of your worker health and safety reforms that happen. It's one event that becomes a lightning rod for reform. Benedict IX acts in a very similar way, right? I keep bringing him up, and I'm not trying to bash the popes here. I want to keep saying here's Benedict IX who sold the papacy 3 times. I'm not trying to bash the pope. What I'm trying to say is he is the lightning rod. Everyone looks at him and goes, he's corrupt. We all know he's corrupt. There's like suspicion of corruptness over here and over there, but you look at him and you go, okay, there's just, everybody knows, right? And so now we have to do something. He is corrupt. It's reached all the way to the top. Well, at that time, an emperor comes up, a German. Keep in mind the whole German, French, Italian kind of circle. That circle's going to keep playing itself out. He's German. Henry III. Right, this is Henry IV's father. Imagine that. Henry III comes up. He will get the name, the moniker, the Pious. Okay, he was tutored by two bishops as a kid. And so those bishops were highly influential on him, and he wants to see the church return to her ideal, return to a place that you could trust, a place that seemed more pious than certainly the corruption that was around. And so when he comes to power, about the time he comes to power is the same time that Benedict IX is in his final term as pope. And so it's Henry III who ultimately orchestrates the excommunication of a pope, Benedict IX. Okay? And he wants reform. He wants a true pope in the papacy, someone who cares about the church. And so he selects a guy by the name of Damascus II. Damascus II is supposedly a reform guy, a guy who wants to bring order to the papacy. And his reign, the other thing, keep in mind, this is a secular appointment. So we've seen with Benedict, he was elected by the people, right? So he's not elected by the people, he's appointed by the emperor. So right now, there is no uniform way by which a pope is always selected. It kind of goes back and forth. So he is appointed by the emperor to take over. His name is Damascus II, and his reign lasts all of 23 days. And then he dies. When you have someone who takes power like that and they die so shortly thereafter, it cannot help but bring up suspicion that there was some sort of conspiracy or poison or whatever. It's hard to substantiate, and history is just kind of silent on it. There are accusations, but just not real sure. It could also have been malaria. Whenever you take a position like that, there's a lot of stress, and with stress, your immunity goes down, so he could have just gotten sick, I guess. But whatever, he only lasts 23 days. Well, after 23 days, he goes back and looks for somebody else, and this time he gets a guy who takes on the moniker Leo IX. Now, it's always interesting. This will happen a number of times in our lifetimes where we will have a pope, right? It is always interesting to see what name the pope chooses for himself. The name he chooses says something about what he intends to do while he's pope. Okay? So this guy chooses Leo IX. He sees himself in the line of Leo the Great. Leo who helped organize the church and helped bring the church to power. Okay, so that's what he sees himself as. He's in the first line of what's called the Reformed Popes, or Reformed Popes. His first act was the act of the Easter Synod of 1049. So we're all the way up middle of the 11th century now. His very first act was a recommitment by the clergy to celibacy. So up until this point, celibacy was encouraged, and at times it was required. But over the past 200 years or so, that requirement has come off. Well, again, when Cluny came back and the Cluny monastery says, okay, we're going to get back to Benedictine rule, we're going to get back to the Benedictine order, one of their primary things was celibacy. And so Leo the Ninth wants sort of those Cluny reforms. He had never been in a Cluny monastery, but he liked what they were doing. And so he makes a commitment to celibacy by the clergy. And by the way, there is, you know, this is always one of those points of contention. We'll actually talk later about marriage and the perpetual virginity of Mary and how that comes in. We'll talk about it when we talk about worship a little bit, I think probably 2 weeks. But one of the interesting things is that they've always got to try and marry this from what we see in the Bible with Peter. And it appears as if Peter is married, right? So you've got to at some point align this complete and total, you can't be married, to the fact that the person from whom you say you are descended and has ultimate authority, we'll read a quote about that soon, that Peter himself appears to be married. Okay, so the only other thing that Leo the Ninth does that you need to be aware of is that he writes a three-part book against simony. Simony is where the bishops either buy their way in, or people in power put someone who has their allegiance to them in power as a bishop. So he says, okay, we're going to write this three-volume work against simony, and its conclusion states that there should be no secular appointment whatsoever. That either the powers, the secular powers, or the laity through election, neither one should be able to appoint a bishop. Only the church should be able to appoint anybody into church office. So, that's Leo the Ninth. He kind of kicks it off. Well, there's a guy. His name is Hildebrand. Hildebrand is an advisor to Leo the Ninth. He gets to be an advisor because he has two unique qualifications. In the first place, he has actually been on the kind of advisory board to a pope before. In the interim between Benedict IX and one of his reigns, there were popes, there were people who wanted to be pope, who came up and vied for the tiara, vied for the throne. And so he helped one of these guys to try and to become pope. He failed, and that pope failed to become pope. And a lot like when you try to become king and you fail, you get out of Dodge, right? Because your neck is on the line. Literally, your neck is on the line, right? So he flees. He tries to get this guy, the papacy. He's defeated. He flees into Gaul, into France and Spain area, to the Saxons. Because the Saxons are at war with the Germans, and the Germans can't get in there, so they can't get his head, right? Well, that's also where the monastery at Cluny happens to be, right? We met William the Pious last week, who started the Cluny movement. And so he ends up near Cluny. He never actually joins Cluny, but he ends up near them, and he ends up spending a lot of time there. And so he's heavily influenced. So by the time Leo comes along, he has experience helping someone in a high position in sort of the papal court, and he has direct experience with Cluny and the reforms that they're trying to put in place. So Leo uses him to try and say, okay, what these reforms, what are they? What are they commitments? How would they look? What would they look like? How do we live them out? Okay. So he gets to be one of Leo's top advisors. He also becomes the backroom power broker for the next four popes. Any of the next four popes who get elected pope, it's because Hildebrand is the one who nominated them and got them put in that position. Okay, everyone looks to him. He is smart. He's not only just smart, he's strategic. During one of these times, another pope, an anti-pope, Benedict X, rises up in Rome. See, the people of Rome didn't really get the memo that we're not supposed to vote on our pope, on our bishop, right? And so the people of Rome voted on a bishop to become the bishop of Rome and therefore pope, even though the German Henry III had appointed somebody to be pope. And so now you've got a pope and an anti-pope. And the question is which, right? So, you know what happens? An army is led by the papal forces to go and take Rome, to seize Rome, okay? You know who leads that army? Hildebrand, right? He's not just an intellectual. He's willing to get his hands dirty. He's really smart, and he's really strategic. By the way, not how we tend to think of our popes today. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine our Pope now, like with a mitre, like commanding a big map, telling people where to go and what to use? I mean, that's just not how we think of him. But at the time, that was not uncommon. In fact, we'll meet later a guy who was elected Pope because of his military strategy, not for any other reason. Okay? They needed a militarist at the time. While you have this succession of popes, a guy is brought to power, a guy is made pope who takes the name Nicholas II. When Nicholas comes to power, Henry III has died. And so his successor is his son, Henry IV. But Henry IV is only 6 years old. And so you have two advisors to Henry IV. You have Henry IV's mom, and you have a bishop. And so the church is now in the highest position of power that it has been in a long time. And so it uses this period to go ahead and enact the consequences, the conclusion of that three-volume work, that there should be no secular appointment. And so what they say is, they say, from here forward, nobody inside the church is appointed except through the church itself. No emperor can appoint a pope. No people can elect a pope, period. Okay? This will be a major point of contention. In 1073, so we were at 1049, we're all the way up to 1073 now, you have four popes in between Leo and Hildebrand. All the rest of the people who were on kind of Leo's court, they're in his inner circle. They have all either been pope or are dead. Hildebrand's the only one left. And so instead of electing somebody else, he gets elected. He becomes pope, and he takes the name Gregory. Gregory VII. This is a watershed. You know, sometimes with historians, and you say, and you ask about a movement, what defines a particular era in history? So, for instance, the early church period, post the apostles, does it end with Constantine? Is Constantine really the beginning of a new era? Or is it really Leo where a new era begins? Because there's some bleed over there, right? So it depends on who you are and how you want to define things. Well, if you're talking about the late medieval period, it is almost unanimously decided that if the beginning of the late medieval period is when Gregory takes the tiara. That's it. That's when it begins, right? He becomes so powerful that this line of popes, all six of them, even though he's at the very end of the line, they're all called Gregorian Reform Popes. Okay, they're all named after him. Again, he's brilliant. He can also be obstinate at times, but he's brilliant. So this Reformation, if there's a book, it's kind of in between a scholarly read and a beach read. It's really good. They're really good stories. But you have to know kind of the movements and the people, or otherwise it goes past you. It's called Reformation in History, right? Really multiple reformations. It's about that thick, right? But its intro tries to give you some of this. How did we get here to the Reformation? And one of the big villains for them is Gregory, right? Gregory defines the church as she became that needed a Reformation. Gregory instituted holy days. This was something that came from his Cluny background. He instituted holy days, and those holy days kind of married with his idea of celibacy, so that even on holy days, people who were married couldn't have marital relations, right? One of the reasons why some people, even in our circles, get a little skittish about Christmas and other kind of holy days is because it's got kind of a Catholic background. They're a little weary about it. First person I ever heard talk about that, by the way, and I didn't grow up inside the Reform movement, so, you know, the mantra I always heard is keep Christ in Christmas, you know? The first person I ever heard on that was Derek Thomas, who in an ST class one time said, I love Christmas. Just keep Christ out of it. Right? As a guy who did not grow up inside the Reform movement, I was like, oh! What? You know, heresy. Of course, you wouldn't call Derek Thomas a heretic. That's just ridiculous. But, you know, I mean, you get this kind of sense of, okay, I get it now. This is one of the reasons why people tend to be very skittish about holy days. Again, a recommitment to celibacy from him. the removal. So not just that simony shouldn't happen. He was willing to, if it could be proven that you got to power because of simony, he's willing to pull you out, right? And then the other thing that he did that, again, we saw this with Ambrose, but we haven't seen it much since him. He actively persecuted heretics. So if you were a heretic, he wanted to use the state power, which the church had now. Keep in mind, with Ambrose said, I'm going to encourage you, emperor, to use your powers to persecute the heretics. We can't do anything about it. We have no state power. Right? Now with Gregory. Gregory says, look, we have state power. We have an army. We will find you and we will persecute you if you're a heretic. Right? Very serious man. Same time that Gregory comes up, Henry has come of age. He was 6 the last time we talked about him, and he just lost a whole bunch of power. Right? He's now of age and he wants to take that power back. And so the very first thing he does after Gregory is elected is he appoints a bishop in Milan. This is a strategic attack on Gregory for 2 reasons. One of Gregory's big deals, and has been from the time he was an advisor to the time he was pope, is no secular appointments, right? Everything comes through the gates. Everything comes through the church to get appointed. The second thing is Milan is a historic bishopric. That's where Ambrose was. Third, Milan is in Italy and is in Rome's backyard. Okay, so this is a very strategic attack on the Pope. Well, Gregory responds, and he responds in a way that's firm yet fatherly, and we'll read a response from him here in a minute that's kind of similar. And Gregory realizes, because he's fighting the Saxons, right? He's got a war going on his eastern front. He realizes he can't fight 2 wars. And the Pope has an army. Keep that in mind. The Pope has an army. He can fight a war. Okay? He cannot fight 2 wars. So he backs down. Let me read you what he says. This is from Henry to Gregory. But we, royal we here, but we, who by God's will have now for some time held the kingly office, have not in all respect shown toward the priesthood such reverence and honor as was due it. We turn to your fatherly indulgence, that we may be found worthy of absolution by your apostolic authority. Notice he's affirming a number of things, right? Priestly office, kingly, kind of underneath the priestly, and apostolic authority. Not only have I encroached upon the property of the church, but I have sold churches themselves to unworthy persons, men poisoned by the gall of simony, men who entered not by the gate, by the church, but by other ways. And I have not defended the churches as I ought to have done. But now, since I cannot regulate the churches alone, without authority from you, I must earnestly beg your advice and help in this matter and in all my affairs. Wow, so not just this matter, in everything. Your directions will be scrupulously followed in all respects. You don't get more of an admission than that, right? It's pretty overwhelming and pretty large in its scope. Well, that's 1073. And in 2 years, 1075, you've got 2 things that happen. One, Gregory issues canons, those laws, right? And Henry defeats the Saxons on his eastern border. And so now he can take his army and focus them on the church. Well, Gregory, seeing that this is about to happen, he issues these canons, one of which says that only, it's his 12th one, only the Pope can depose an emperor. Now, you need to recognize that this is a tremendous step for the church. Because the church now has said, look, we crown emperors, right? We saw Charlemagne last week, was it, where he kind of took the crown himself and crowned himself. But there's always been a play back and forth. And the church has asserted, we're the ones who crown emperors. But now, what he's saying is that if you don't fall in line, I can take your crown away from you. Right? This is not reform. That's revolution. Okay? second thing is, it's an absolute flip-flop with what had happened with Henry's father. Henry's father, Henry III, had excommunicated a pope. Right? So, and Henry knows that. How happy do you think Henry is to hear that law? Yeah, not real happy. Let me read to you what Henry says. Henry, when he finds this out, he does kind of the same trick second time, what he did last time. He appoints the exact same guy to the exact same place. Exact same guy, Bishop of Milan. Right? So Gregory writes another response back and says, look, you can't do this. Very similar to what he did the first time. This time, Henry replies. Again, keep in mind what you heard the first time. This is different. Henry, king, not by usurpation, but by the pious ordination of God, to Hildebrand, not pope, but false monk. That's how he starts it. Right? None of this like apostolic authority, priestly, No, you're not even really the pope. In fact, you're not even really a monk. You're a false monk. You have trodden the bishops underfoot like slaves who knew not what their lord may do. You dared to threaten to take the kingship away from us, again, royal we, as though we had received it from you, as though kingship and empire were in your hand and not in the hand of God. Our Lord Jesus Christ has called us to kingship, but not called you to the priesthood. The true Pope, St. Peter, also exclaims, fear God, honor the king, 1 Peter 2:17. Wherefore, when St. Paul gave no quarter to an angel from heaven, if the angel should preach heterodoxy, he did not accept you, who are now teaching heterodoxy throughout the earth. This is a good argument. Listen to what he's saying. He's saying, look, Paul has said in Scripture, the gospel that I proclaim right now is the gospel. Should there be any other gospel, it is heterodoxy. And what you're preaching is different than what Paul wrote in this letter. Therefore, you're the one out of accord, not me. He quotes Paul. For he says, if anyone, either I or an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. So what is the action if someone preaches other than what Paul preaches? They're to be accursed. The church calls this anathema, anathematized. It's you are cursing someone, and by cursing them outside the fellowship of the church, you are sentencing them to hell. So he says, descend, therefore, condemned by this anathema, not descend off the throne. He's already called him a false monk. I, Henry, king by grace of God, together with all our bishops, say to you, descend, descend.
He just told the Pope to go to hell.
Right? That's what he just did. Right? I mean, this is like popcorn, Coke, like, awesome. I'll see what happens next, you know? This is like Cold War, U.S. and Russia, and they've called everything off, and they're just lobbing nukes at each other, you know? See who survives. How do you think Gregory took that? Yeah, not real well, right? Gregory issues, via a prayer, this. O blessed Peter, Prince of the Apostles, mercifully incline thine ear. By thy favor, not by any works of mine, I believe that it is and has been thy will that the Christian people, especially committed to thee, should render obedience to me, thy especially constituted representative. To me is given by thy grace the power of binding and loosing in heaven and upon earth. We would say that's a misapplication of that scripture. I deprive King Henry, who has rebelled against thy church with unheard of audacity, of the government over the whole kingdom of Germany and Italy. So I have now absolved him of all governmental control whatsoever. And I release all Christian men from the allegiance which they have sworn or may swear to him. And this is just brilliant, this last part. I'm telling you, smart guy. And I forbid anyone to serve him as king. Do you see the dilemma that he has just placed every single person under? They can't just go down to the Baptist church down the road. You know, these Presbyterians are crazy. They go down to the Baptist church or the Methodist church or whatever, right? This is the church. This is it, right? So if you're going to be religious, the head of your religion has just told you, you either are loyal to the king or you're loyal to me. Those are your two options. Right? So, the German nobility gets involved. And they hold a diet. Diet is in, like, we all get together and talk, not diet is in, hey, we need to lose a couple pounds. They hold a diet, and they talk. And when this diet happens, even Henry's representatives run over, because you've got papal legates, that is people who represent the Pope, and you've got Henry's representatives. And even Henry's representatives run to the papal legates, and they say, forgive us. Right? Forgive us. Because they don't want to be outside the church. The nobility overwhelmingly supports the Pope and not Henry. Right? And Henry has lost every single bit of power that he has ever had. Right? He's in a position where if it wasn't for the fact that the Saxons were rebuilding and about to fight them again on the east, he probably would have been executed at that point. Right? The German nobility would have had him executed and somebody else would have been the king. But they knew that they couldn't have that because it would cause chaos, and they've got the Saxons to deal with. Okay? Well, it's a quarter till. We'll pick this up next week, and I'll tell you what happens. And what happens with Henry. You can Google it if you want to be a party pooper. But if I were you, I would just wait until next week. Any questions?